My name is Madison Daniels. I'm from Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and I'm kind of the moderator slash, and we had a panelist drop out, and so I'm going to also be kind of participating also. And so I'll kind of give the names of our panelists, and they'll come up, and then we'll just have give them some time to introduce themselves. And then open up for panel discussion for it. So it's a 90-minute session. Open it up for group discussion amongst our panelists. So I've got some questions prepared, and then the last 20 minutes or so we'll do Q&A with the audience. So if you guys have questions, be thinking, because we've got plenty of time for it. So we've got Rachel Lauritzen over here on my left. She'll be, I don't want to steal all your thunder about who you are. We've got Soren Simonsen and Mark Coles-Ritchie, they will be gracing me on this panel up here. Oh, no, come up now. I mean, yeah, sure, you can wait. Yeah, you can wait. So if you want, just, we're winging this. We're all friends. We all know each other, so we're all just going to wing this. Yeah, so go for it. This way.
Okay. So we had talked about splitting up the time so you get to know us, and mine ended up being a little bit part introduction, part like introduction to me, and part getting into the topic. And I'm just going to go ahead and start with what I've got. Is this close enough? Is this right? Okay. One of my earlier memories is of a favorite song from my childhood, learned in primary, and associated with vivid imaginings of what it described. Whenever I hear the song of a bird, or look at the blue, blue sky, whenever I feel the rain on my face, or the wind as it rushes by, whenever I touch a velvet rose, or walk by our lilac tree, I'm glad that I live in this beautiful world Heavenly Father created for me. He gave me my eyes that I might see the color of butterfly wings. He gave me my ears that I might hear the magical sound of things. He gave me my life, my mind, my heart. I thank him reverently for all his creations of which I'm a part. Yes, I know Heavenly Father loves me. I suppose if I were to pinpoint the beginnings of my environmentalist tendencies, this would be it. This early love of nature, of God's creation, combined with lessons of thrift from my parents, was something that I appreciated early on. Through playing in the nearby woods and mountains, to wanting a natural style as a teenager, to being a BYU student interested in the newly growing field of organics, despite my roommate's warning that people who eat too much organic food lose their ability to eat regular food. If only she could see me now. In many ways, I was the product of the Utah culture I grew up in, my awareness of environmental issues fairly limited, even as it grew over time. I was glad when Salt Lake County announced its recycling program for the unincorporated area where I lived and persuaded my roommates to sign up for it. But I didn't start becoming active or actively educated on the issues until I was married and moved into a city that didn't have recycling. I found it a mild annoyance at first and took the initiative to call up the mayor of my town to say, would the city please provide curbside recycling? This was a real first step for me, as I'd never really gotten involved in government before besides to vote. However, his response was disappointing. He maintained that we were in a low and fixed income area, which was true, and that the residents wouldn't want to pay for it, which was debatable. I hung up the phone a little frustrated, but my stubbornness had been awakened. I took recyclables elsewhere for the better part of a year, and then, finally, I decided to call the mayor again. We had a conversation almost exactly the same as the first, but this time I was more insistent. Finally, he suggested that I could take my idea to the city council. I think he was trying to get rid of me. I eventually did this after finding out how the meetings worked, getting suggestions from council members, getting involved in other city programs, and eventually spearheading a citywide petition and calling waste management companies for cost information to present a compelling case to the council. After they stopped blinking at a resident actually showing up, and with a record-breaking number of signatures, they started the process that led to our getting a voluntary curbside recycling program the next year, and eventually a citywide program. This project, I believe, led to the next mayor offering me a seat on the City Planning Commission. I served for 8 years and brought my slowly accumulating environmental best practices to my perspective and voting decisions there, while introducing things like bike lanes and backyard chicken ordinances. And just as a side note, I believe we had some members of the Jordan River Commission come to some of our planning meetings, both for presentations and so that we could incorporate some of their recommendations. All this time, I was taking the slow, gentle approach, hoping that by small and simple means, great things would come to pass. I thought that if I could be the change I wanted to see in the world, able to answer questions about day-to-day changes because I'd worked through them myself, the issues and habit changes needed to reverse climate change would normalize in my sphere of influence and spread outward, helping us to meet the crucial requirements for maintaining a healthy environment. And while there has been some change, some greater awareness of these things in the last decade or so, both in my own small sphere as well as the global community, there has not been nearly enough. I decided it was time to take a more active approach, and as I thought things over, it occurred to me that one area I hadn't used my influence as effectively as I could was in my church circle. Part of this was due to the perception that environmentalism is political, or more precisely, partisan. I personally don't think the underlying issues are, but the talking points have, rightly or wrongly, become strongly associated with the political left. And as a conservative right-leaning denomination, our culture and discourse has distanced itself from those issues. Added to this is the trend in church culture toward disposables for church functions and services. I think this is largely due to well-intentioned convenience and perceived thrift. Leadership doesn't want the same few people doing the dishes after a war dinner when everyone else has gone home and the plastic sacrament cups are cheaper than the paper ones. My response is that, like cleaning the building, we can plan for enough people to share the added work and that reusables will save money over time, leaving extra for the smallish added expense of paper products when single-use products are needed. I also think that if we make an effort to see the larger good of not externalizing the costs of convenience and disposable, especially with plastic, then we can add environmentally friendly practices to our list of worthy actions that we do despite it being less convenient, the less easy path. I have not yet heard a conference talk that prioritizes the virtues of convenience in matters of well-being, and I think that being eco-friendly qualifies as a matter of well-being. In fact, the well-being of others is something that we are regularly exhorted to consider and align our actions with. And the costs of climate change are being borne most by those least resilient to it and responsible for it. Many of the world's poor are in areas most affected by extreme heat, extreme flooding, and environmental pollution. They lack the political, social, and financial resources to protect themselves or to move out of those conditions, and are losing health, livelihood, and life because of these conditions, which will only become more desperate as the climate crisis escalates. Furthermore, the changing climate will make life increasingly more difficult for generations to come, a heavy consequence not of their making. So when we consider Jesus' question, "Who is my neighbor?" and our mandate to care for the poor and needy, we see that environmentalism can be a core part of our Christianity, of sharing our burdens, of loving each other, and being one with one another. We also have an explicit charge to not only till the earth, but to take care of it. One of the semantic hurdles we have is the biblical description of humanity having dominion over other of God's creations. I personally interpret this as a calling to responsible stewardship, not a license to exploit, pollute, or deplete. But my interpretation does not seem to be the dominant one. In fact, a friend of mine pointed out that a common belief seems to be that we don't have to worry about the degradation of the earth, because when Jesus comes again, he'll wave his all-powerful hand and take care of it for us. But I think this is at odds with our foundational doctrines of both personal agency and responsibility for our actions. I think that, like any wise parent, God is not going to let us trash our home and then clean it up for us. We are going to have to do the work, and I think that the sooner we get to it, the better off we'll be. We are called on to be wise and faithful servants now, not after the Lord returns. And finally, I believe that to truly honor God and God's creation, we must love it, all of it. Stephen Jay Gould, an evolutionary biologist, said, "We cannot win this battle to save species and environments without forging an emotional bond between ourselves and nature, for we will not fight to save that which we do not love." In the same vein, we have a created planet with plants and animals that God has declared good and told us to take good care of. We can best do that if we cultivate a deep love for and relationship with that creation, just as we are asked to do with God personally and our brothers and sisters. I believe that the commandment to love God and others includes all other beings, animal, plant, and the earth itself. We believe the earth to be our eventual heaven, a temple in the making. We talk much of sacred spaces, and the earth is one such place, Zion, if you will. But I also believe that it won't become Zion, pure and unified, until we include it in a oneness, a unity of the connectedness of, and a reverence for all creation in our hearts. Thich Nhat Hanh said that we are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness. Jesus tells us that we must learn to be one. This is Zion. And so, environmentalism is not incidental to my faith. It is integral to it. And my faith is integral to my environmentalism. As the primary song says, for all his creations of which I'm a part, yes, I know Heavenly Father loves me.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Rachel. That was really great. Mark, do you want to go?
Yeah.
Sorry, we had like 5 minutes to try and set up.
Just unplug one and plug in the other. It's all screwed in VGA style. Yeah, the HDMI.
We're playing it fast and loose here. We're just watching it all happen. It's happening live.
I need a little bit of light. Can you? There you go. Thanks. Let's see. Madison, do you know how to show the screen? I'll get started. My name is Mark Coles Ritchie. And I'm glad to be on this panel about faith and stewardship.
Okay, this is projecting your main screen. So if you want to swap, or do you not want this to be your main screen? You want it to be your second screen?
No, PC screen only. No, that's not it. Second screen.
Can I extend it?
Can't get rid of this stuff.
Oops. I'm playing too fast. Which one do you want?
I don't know. Try each one? Duplicate? That'll work.
We can just make this full screen.
Sure. No, that didn't work.
Which one? Here, I'll let you press the buttons to actually get it to work.
How did you do that? Oops. That's fine. I don't want to waste any more time. To introduce myself, I live here in Salt Lake City with my family, and my wife Marilee is here. Thanks for coming, Marilee, and I have two kids. I work for Grand Canyon Trust, a conservation group, and I'm trained in vegetation ecology. I love plants and wildflowers, and I'm going to show some pictures of those. So I spend a lot of time out in the field documenting the conditions on our public lands and trying to promote protection of these beautiful places. when I was thinking about this presentation, I was trying to figure out how I got interested in conservation and what fostered my love of nature. I'm going to see if I can back up here. There we go. And how I developed this love of the beauty of the earth. And I love the song For the Beauty of the Earth, and Rachel mentioned a song. And it's interesting how many of our church songs talk about the beauty of the earth and talk about all creatures of our God and King and the beautiful mountains, on the mountains high, and the streams, clear-flowing streams, and Gibbs said the little stream. Do they still do that in primary? And I love how in our doctrine there's a lot of emphasis, at least especially in the songs, about the beauty of the earth. I don't think we always follow as much as we should that those admonitions to respect the beauty of the earth and to value it. I think we all do appreciate nature and the mountains and the rivers and the forests and the flowers and the animals, but I don't think we always do enough to protect those places, keep them natural and beautiful. I think we assume that they will stay that way forever, and I don't think we realize the risks of losing those places, and we are losing them, and climate change is an even bigger threat to these places. So to back up to how I got interested in conservation, I remember as a young man going out on scouting and young men's hikes and backpacking trips, and I think that was one of the starting points for my love of nature. The Wind River Mountains was a backpacking trip that is indelibly imprinted in my mind, and the beautiful mountains and rivers and forests of the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming is one. We did other backpacking and snowshoeing trips. I had a great scoutmaster in the Orem 27th Ward that took us out and was really dedicated. So that was one of the things that started my love of nature. My family also did trips. We went to national parks a lot, and we camped, and we didn't do big hikes, but we walked around in the national parks, and I gained a love of nature with my family. In college, I can't remember exactly how it happened, but I got interested in the environment and how it was being harmed, and pollution and damage and destruction of whales. And one thing that really stuck in my mind was the river that caught on fire. Some of you will remember, can't remember, the Cuyahoga or something like that in Ohio in the, I think it was the early 70s or late 60s. And it caught on fire multiple times, I'm told. But seeing the video of that river catching on fire because of all the pollution just really stuck in my mind. So all of these things sort of motivated me to get involved in the environmental movement when I was in my early 20s. And I had been a missionary, and then I went to work for Greenpeace as a canvasser. So I became a missionary for the environment. We would knock on doors, and just like as a missionary, we wouldn't always get a great response. But I was proselytizing for the environment and canvassing to try to raise money for Greenpeace in my post-mission days, or a continuation of my mission, really. And so ever since then, I've been interested in environmental protection and conservation. And so I did some academic work, multiple degrees, studying environmental science and conservation, and then went to work for some advocacy groups and worked for the Forest Service. And now I'm back in advocacy with Grand Canyon Trust, a conservation group, and I work in southern Utah trying to protect those beautiful places. And all of this is also fostered by my faith. And I believe that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints teaches us, as Rachel said, to be stewards, to care for the land, to respect and revere and hold sacred the earth and the beauties of the earth. And I'm just going to scroll through some of these just to give you a taste for the beauty of Utah. All of these photos are taken in central and southern Utah. The temple focuses on the creation and the importance of that in the eyes of God. And I think if I take from that God's respect and reverence for the earth and how important the creation is, and it goes through all the steps, the major steps of the creation, and particularly the plants and animals, so the living things on the earth that are so important, and we should admire, respect, and care for these beautiful living things. And I'm going to show you some of these living things. I'm a plant ecologist, so most of the photos are plants, but I love animals too. I think about Jesus going to the wilderness and spending the 40 days in the wilderness contemplating and going through preparation for his ministry, and the wilderness and nature as a place of renewal and inspiration and motivation to do good. And that's what it is for me. When I go hiking in these beautiful places, this is the La Salle Mountains by Moab, I'm invigorated and inspired and motivated to, first of all, respect nature and God's creation, and also to be a better person. Moses went up to mountains to commune with God. Joseph Smith went to the forest to commune with God, to seek that solitude and that inspiration and a place of peace. How long have I gone, Madison? I want to read a scripture, DNC 59, to tie it specifically to the sacred writings of our faith, of my faith. In DNC 59, it talks about living according to the commandments, the Ten Commandments in particular, and loving God, loving our fellow men, being good and kind. And it ends with the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath day holy. And then it says, starting in verse 16, "Verily I say that inasmuch as ye do this," the things that have just been said about keeping the commandments, "the fullness of the earth is yours, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air, and that which climbeth upon the trees and walketh upon the earth, yea, and the herb and the good things which come of the earth, whether for food or for raiment or for houses or for barns or for orchards or for gardens or for vineyards. Yea, all things which come of the earth in the season thereof are made for the benefit and the use of man, both to please the eye and to gladden the heart. Yea, for food and for raiment, for taste and for smell, to strengthen the body and to enliven the soul. And it pleaseth God that he hath given all these things unto man, for unto this end were they made, to be used with judgment, not to excess, neither by extortion." This scripture is packed full of reverence and appreciation for the things of the earth, and also counsel for how we should receive and use and enjoy these things. Not use them up necessarily. To some degree we use them up, but not entirely, because it says not only should we... not only should these things benefit us, but they should please our eye and gladden our heart and enliven our soul. And to me, that's what nature and God's creation does. It enlivens my soul, gladdens my heart, and it pleases my eye. And I think as we go on, we'll talk more about sacred places. And I'm just going to scroll through some of these. To me, these are sacred places, places where I can commune with God as I'm hiking or eating my lunch up on the mountains or in the desert, or as I'm seeing the magnificent archaeology, the cultural sites of the people of southern that were in this area long before the pioneers came for thousands of years. This is in Bears Ears National Monument, sacred places to Navajo, Hopi, Ute, and Zuni. And I wore my Zuni bracelet today to recognize Native peoples that I think we don't respect enough in our culture for their love and appreciation for the land. Some amazing rock art in Bears Ears. This is the spring in Bears Ears with Columbine, alcove Columbine. Fireweed in the Wasatch Plateau after a fire, showing the rejuvenation of the earth. Another Columbine. Left Fork Huntington Creek, that Marilee will recognize. And Jacob's Ladder in a wetland. A beautiful wildflower. And finally, I love streams, so I have a couple of photos of streams and beautiful willows and sedges along the stream. So I just wanted to end there, and we'll continue this discussion, but I have a great appreciation for nature, and I'm so grateful to get to work in these beautiful places and to help protect them, and I think we can do better as a church and better as a people and as a society in respecting these places and protecting them, and I hope we can talk more about that today. Thanks.
Turn this off.
Thanks, Mark. Rachel, if you want to... Where'd you go? Oh, you're turning on the lights. Thank you, Rachel, for turning on the lights for us. We're our own AV people, too. We're panelists, and we're AV people. It's amazing. Thank you. All right, now we'll hear from Soren Simonson.
Thank you, Madison. Thank you, Mark and Rachel, both. What really inspiring and thought-provoking commentaries. There may be some similar themes to some of what you've heard from them in my own thoughts. I want to start just by reading a statement that I put together actually for a table that we have set up here for the Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance, which kind of brings together different aspects of some of my thoughts about, you know, our place in caring for the natural world. The earth was created to sustain life. We often think of that as being human life, and yet we know from pronouncements in both ancient sacred scriptures and LDS, Latter-day Saint sacred scriptures, that all life has purpose, not just human life, but all life. All was declared good. It all has purpose, and it was all created and given the mandate to fulfill the measure of its creation. So when the earth thrives, we thrive too, and all living things thrive. When we elect our representatives, we're often reminded by church leaders that principles compatible with the gospel may be found in various political parties and candidates. This from a letter from the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 2014, just prior to the election. As citizens, we have the privilege and duty of influencing public policy. Participation in the political process affects our communities and nation today and in the future. We often think of our responsibilities as ending at the ballot booth, and we certainly have a lot of political influence around parties. But I want to talk a little bit about what I see as really one of the major pressing issues of our time that gets very little coverage from our faith. Today we know that many of the Earth's ecological systems are threatened, the systems that were designed by God to sustain life. Our air, our water, our land, our atmosphere are all in extreme danger. Many of these sacred life support systems need divinely inspired help, and that comes from us. We're God's servants to do his will, and his will is to care for the earth. Too often, the principles and values of our faith are mistakenly replaced with corporate interests, with political platforms, and with other human ideologies. When it comes to caring for the earth, we should not be looking to the right or to the left for answers from political entities. We should be looking up instead. Environmental stewardship and conservation are sacred responsibilities that are directed by God. So I want to share a little bit about my environmental spiritual journey with you. My mother is a German immigrant. She grew up in World War II in Karlsruhe and Friedrichshafen, Germany. And so I grew up listening to stories about what it was like to live in a country ravaged by war and political turmoil when you had very little and you had to make do with a lot. She often used this phrase, which I'm sure we've heard in many LDS contexts: use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. I heard another phrase when I was in college. I think it's the first time I've heard it: reduce, reuse, recycle. It's often used by people that tend to lean left. And yes?
I heard it last month. Reduce, reuse, recycle, refuse.
There you go. Expand it. Refuse straws. When you think about it, these two phrases are saying pretty much the same thing. Think about it. Use it up, wear it out, make it do, do without. Use it up, reuse, wear it out, recycle, make it do, reuse, or do without, reduce. So they're all in there. So, I grew up in a home with, as I mentioned, my mother coming from World War II Germany. And so we didn't have formally organized recycling programs in Austin, Texas, where I grew up at the time. But she found different ways to collect much of the waste that we had: paper, plastic, glass bottles, plastic bags, whatever. And even we never had Tupperware to save food and things like that. We didn't have plastic bags to put sandwiches in. Mom would save whatever plastic containers that sour cream and butter and other things came in, and that was our Tupperware. And so that was kind of the environment that I grew up in. And even though my mom is very conservative and very right-leaning on the political spectrum, she really was the epitome of these concepts of making do and reusing and really thinking about waste stream. So that was a definite influence on me. And my kids call me the recycling Nazi around our house. I scold when the waste stream goes in the wrong sorting container in our home, and my wife rolls her eyes sometimes when I tell her that the Diet Coke cans shouldn't go in the trash can under the sink in the bathroom. That's for real trash, and recycling can go in the recycling bin. Another experience that I had when I was young, I was probably 14 or 15, and my father was a scoutmaster at the time, and we traveled from Texas up the I-35 corridor to the Boundary Waters in Minnesota, and spent about 2 weeks paddling the Boundary Waters, the area of the 10,000 lakes up in northern Minnesota and central Canada. And there were two incidents that happened there that were really pivotal for me. First of all, this was a few years after I remember hearing a talk given by LDS prophet Spencer W. Kimball about killing the little birds, or not killing the little birds. Some of you might remember that. It was in the, I think, 1978. I was probably 10 or 11 years old at the time. And while we were out hiking in the woods as we were preparing to leave on our paddling excursion, I was wearing a bandana, and I took it off, and we were kind of, popping each other, as Boy Scouts tend to do, riling each other up. And there was a little frog that hopped across a log in front of me. And so just out of almost kind of spontaneity, I just whipped it, and the frog immediately flipped upside down and was dead. And I remembered, this don't kill the little birds. It immediately came into my mind, and I thought, what have I just done? And so that was a really moving kind of personal experience for me about, having this distinct impression that all life is sacred. Human life is certainly sacred in a special way, but all life is sacred. The other thing that happened during that trip, which was really remarkable to me, was when we went out on the lakes, I remarked to our guide at the beginning of the journey, I said, where are our water containers? Where do we store water while we're, you know, we're going to be out for 2 weeks? And we have cups and plates and utensils, but we have nothing to store water in. He says, you don't need to store water. The water is clear and clean. Just dip your cup in the lakes and drink. And I grew up in a city of lakes in Austin, Texas, and the thought of drinking water out of a body of water that you were in was just completely foreign to me. And so that was really remarkable that places like that exist where it is so clean and pure and pristine. And those 2 weeks were really remarkable. It's probably the best traveling experience that I ever had in my youth. To the point of thinking about wildlife, I wanted to just share this commentary. This is from the Zion's Camp March a commentary from Joseph Smith. In pitching my tent, we found 3 Massasauguas, or prairie rattlesnakes, which the brethren were about to kill. But I said, let them alone, don't hurt them. How will the serpent ever lose his venom while the servants of God possess the same disposition and continue to make war upon it? Men must become harmless before the brute creation, and when men lose their vicious dispositions and cease to destroy the animal race, the lion and the lamb can dwell together, and the suckling child can play with the serpent in safety. And to my family members and friends and others that sometimes say, you know, we don't have to worry so much about what we do with the earth because God will figure it out. This is not a commentary that says we don't have to worry about it. In fact, this to me really speaks to the kind of temperament that we should be working towards if we are to usher in a millennial period of peace. We should be working to build our communion with all life, all animal species, and with each other. I had an interesting experience just before I left on a mission to Norway. My parents took me to Park City. We left Austin. We came up to Park City, and we spent about 4 or 5 days before I went into the Missionary Training Center reading the Book of Mormon from cover to cover. And it's a very different kind of book when you read it like a novel, rather than studying and poring over the pages like we most often do, reading bits and pieces, selecting scriptures on topics. To read it like a novel is a very different kind of perspective. And one of the things that I gain from that is the cycles of destruction that men and women, I guess, but probably mostly men are inclined to. And you see these cycles when you read the Book of Mormon like a novel, how rapidly these things happen. And the ultimate destruction of the Nephite peoples is really, I think, a metaphor. When Moroni says that this book will speak to the dust to us in the latter days, I believe that part of what he's talking about is this destructive tendency that we have as human beings. And it's typically related to consumerism and pride and relinquishing our responsibility to the poor and relinquishing our responsibility to care for the earth. Those cycles are very much tied in, the cycles that we see in the Nephites in the Book of Mormon. So let me just wrap up with a couple of thoughts. First of all, when we think about the Lord's house, the holy temples, and I know many of the Latter-day Saint faith traditions have temples as very significant to their worship, to their ways of communing with deity. When we think about the Lord's house, we think of it as a place to treat with great care. And if we think of the Lord's earth, it is, after all, his. Shouldn't we be treating it with the same care as we would treat his house? Christ frequently calls the earth his footstool, his home, his abode. So it's not just those special houses that are places for caring, but it's the earth in general. The calamities that are described in Matthew 24 are very consistent with the calamities that are expressed by scientists today about the destructive work that people are doing to the planet. Climate change, environmental degradation, pollution. And when you think about the calamities that are very specifically referenced, they're almost identical to the predictions that we hear about how we how we are changing the earth. And this is my own sense, my own feeling, but the 1,000 years of restorative period may very well be cleaning up all of the mess that we create today. And scientists, in fact, are saying that it may take 1,000 years to reverse the impacts of climate change that will be very destructive in coming decades. And so when I think about what a Latter-day Saint or Mormon or Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints environmental movement looks like, first of all, it has to be a movement. We can't just rely on political parties and environmentalists and others. We should be leading, I believe, as people that share communion of the restoration, should be leading the movement to care for the earth and to demonstrate what restoration looks like, what replenishing the earth looks like. I want to just end with a statement that's very much at the forefront of my thought and work that I'm trying to do today, and that is a talk that was given about the creation in 2000 by the current Latter-day Saint prophet, Russell M. Nelson. He said, "As beneficiaries of the divine creation, what should we do? We should care for the earth, be wise stewards over it, and preserve it for future generations, and we are to love and care for one another." Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Soren. Okay, so now I've got some questions that I'm going to ask our panelists. We're going to go till 3:15, and then we're going to open up for questions for the audience. So keep an eye on the time. That gives us about 30 minutes. So we've talked in each of your kind of presentations, you mentioned how each one of your own faith. You know, within the Mormon Church, has kind of led you to care for the earth. So when the theme of Sunstone this year is the future of faith, and so the question is when we're talking about the future of faith, why is it absolutely crucial, and why should everyone who's at this symposium actually be in this room right now to think about the environmental crisis?
Well, there's the practical reasons, like Soren was talking about. We've polluted and destroyed a lot of the earth, and so we need to fix that, stop the destruction, and fix the places we've destroyed. But I think there's also a spiritual component to becoming better stewards of the earth and more connected to the earth. I think as we do that, we become closer to God, and I think we become more humble and more tender people as we are more connected to the earth. That's a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say very similarly. I mean, there is the practical aspect of having a habitable planet. If you don't have a habitable planet, then you don't really have a faith because you're not here anymore. But I do think that also that the spirit of the gospel and of, you know, the principles that we teach, if we are not living them in relation to our fellow beings, whether they be human or otherwise, and the place that we live on, then we don't really understand them because we're not taking them into our hearts and seeing the beauty that is there. And so, and from an outsider's perspective, if you say, well, you say you believe these things, but you don't practice them, it becomes very off-putting because you're not putting your walk where your talk is. So it's really a question of how can we truly live that faith?
You know, I guess a couple of thoughts that come to my mind. There seems to be some abdication of responsibility to governments and political processes to take care of the world around us. Somehow we've kind of, like we often do with so many things in our consumer society, we don't see that the outputs necessarily. We don't see our waste stream. We don't see what happens to all of the things that we consume. They're out of sight and out of mind. And in some ways, I think we've done that with our responsibility. I was involved in a conversation not long ago. Looking at respect for the environment. And 100 years ago, when we were an agrarian society, you lived with the earth. The earth worked for you, and you had to work with it and for it in order to sustain life, your own life, and that of your family. So many things, I think, about our consumer society today have just pushed out, externalized so many things that we take for granted. And it's a real tragedy, I think. We've even externalized our need to speak out and to speak up and to be engaged, and not politically engaged, which is often where that dialogue happens, but just engaged as a community. I think there is a lot of need to be raising questions around the environment in our community dialogues that happen in our congregations. We should be talking about recycling, and we should be talking about, when we're planning activities in a ward or in a meeting house or a neighborhood, we should be talking about our waste stream when we pass the sacrament around and throw all of the leftovers, the plastic cups and everything in the trash can. I think those are all too much externalized conversations, and they're producing really unfortunate results that I think have changed our sensitivity and sensibility about what our relationship is with the earth.
Thank you. So I work for an environmental organization. Soren works for an environmental organization. Mark works for an environmental organization. So there's a lot of organizations that are actively involved and engaged in trying to protect and preserve lands and ensure that the future environmental crisis is at least dealt with in some way. But one thing that I found consistently, especially as I've started to show up here at some of these more Mormon-centric events, is I have to, and this is a question that I think is on a lot of people's minds, why is it so important for religious institutions and communities of faith to get involved and be part of the process of solving this global problem of environmental crisis?
Well, maybe I'll dive in on this one first. I think virtually every faith tradition that I have studied, it has very strong connections to the creation, to our relationship with God, to what our place is on the planet. We're not owners. We're stewards, and that's a very, very consistent theme across most faith traditions. And so when we think about the environmental movement, I think it has been captured in the political arena in ways that have been unfortunate, because we've essentially discontinued our dialogue within our faith communities about this topic. And yet it is such a moral and ethical issue that I think we have to reclaim it. When I was working on my master's thesis at Westminster College here in Salt Lake a few years ago, my background is in urban planning, architecture, city development, community development, and I did a master's thesis that focused, my capstone project focused on what does the future of cities look like in the 21st century, and how do we chart a course to make cities sustainable rather than susceptible to some of the really enormous challenges that we face, and environmental degradation, limitations of natural resources, enormous population expansion were some of those kind of chief areas that I explored. And it was interesting that in doing research even within a professional community, as I did surveys and focus groups, frequently this topic that we need more leadership from faith communities around environment to support this. And I think part of that is because that's the most fundamental level where we have conversations about what our values and beliefs are. We don't have that in school. We don't have that in the professional world. We have important conversations in those places. But the most foundational conversations that we have around what we believe and what we value and what we cherish happen in our faith communities. And so I think that is the most important place to be having conversations about environmental stewardship, because that's where you solidify that as a value system, as a belief, as a foundational piece of who we are as human beings.
I'm going to add to that by saying that I think it's through those conversations and getting people of faith involved that you start to decouple the politicization of environmental issues, because it is such a common refrain and it's so strongly associated with the political left, and the religious left has picked it up because, you know, that doesn't interfere with their identity. But the religious right, not so much, because we've got this political image to go with. And if we can decouple from that politically and start to see those moral and ethical implications, you know, the impact to the poor. I also think that the religious community has that moral framework to say, well, it doesn't merely have to be about capitalism and corporations and all of that, because every religious tradition I know of has that community focus greater than just financial gain. And so to decouple it from the political realm, to get more communities of faith involved from the whole spectrum of political backgrounds, will not only reframe that discussion, it will get more people involved. And the more people will get involved, the more action we can take, the sooner we can reverse the harmful effects that are taking place.
I agree completely. More people involved, I think, is critical. And churches can really do that, especially in a church like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, where people follow the guidance of the leaders for the most part. The church could really, really quickly move the environmental movement along if they, from the pulpit and in the writings, said, we need to do these things to protect our environment. And if they set the example by putting solar panels on all the churches, imagine how much electricity that would generate and how much of a motivator that would be for other people, and it would do a lot. The church could motivate us as members to do individual things, to use less water, to use more green energy, to reduce our production of waste. So the church just has a really powerful influence on a lot of people, and that influence, I think, would spread beyond the church if, when the church makes these moves to be more environmentally minded.
Thank you. I feel like I'll add to this a little bit, because my entire job, I'm a faith community organizer, and so I kind of live in this really weird realm between communities of faith and communities who are actively are engaged in trying to do environmental things in Utah, and it's kind of a weird pool for me to be in, but I am energized and invigorated by it. Because are there any Lord of the Rings fans in here? Okay, yeah, a fair few. I feel like I just have this conviction that the religious communities, not just in Utah, but in America and in the world, are like the Ents in the forest that just need to wake up and see that they're a part of this world and this forest and what's happening right outside their forest. And as soon as like a Merry and Pippin can like show him what actually like what's going on, like that's going to turn the tide of this entire thing. And I am convicted about that. And so that's why I think it's so important to get the religious communities involved. Mark, you kind of touched on this. What do you think, Mormonism can uniquely offer both the religious landscape and the world in terms of solving the environmental crisis. Because I'm sure you all know that the Pope Francis came out with an encyclical on Laudato Si, which is Care for Our Common Home, which is a full-on, it's kind of a booklet, a little novella on why Catholics should care for the earth. And so Catholics have this phenomenal kind of foundation already. But what do you think Mormons can uniquely offer both the religious landscape and the world as far as solving this environmental problem? That's a big one.
I'll start with our organization. I mean, whenever there's a call to get everybody out, let's sandbag, let's do whatever it is, or just dump a lot of food at the family's house, that is already very much in structure, and reaching out to the community with the different programs where we sort of fellowship and take care of each other, and as well as the recent encouragement to go outside of those programs. But that organization is a big part of it. I think also if we were to give more focus to our doctrinal underpinnings of, you know, seeing the earth as a being, a living being, which will be our home in, you know, after the second coming and all that. But to put that that perspective and that respect towards it, those are the two that first come to my mind. I'm not sure if that's all of them.
Yeah, I touched on this a little bit already, but I think, like Rachel says, we're a well-organized church. We can respond quickly to needs, and people generally are really committed to following the leaders. And so I think if there was more direction, more guidance, more emphasis on environmental stewardship, it would, a lot would happen quickly. And I think the world would see, oh, wow, those folks are getting a lot of good stuff done. Let's follow that lead.
I don't know if I have really anything to add. Great thoughts.
All right, that's okay. So I want to ask two questions at once, and you can respond to both or either part. So number one, where do you think we are as a church right now as in terms of community, and what do you think we could do better? And instead of what do you think we could do better, if you could wave a magic wand and change three things about what will we do as a community and as a church, what would they be? So first, where do you think we are? And if you could wave a magic wand and change three things, what would you do? If you were president for a day.
President of the church?
President of the church, if you were prophet for a day.
I don't know if I can come up with three, but I had an interesting experience about maybe three years ago. There's a woman named Catherine Hayhoe. I don't know if that name rings a bell. If you work in the climate science world, you've probably heard her name. She's a very outspoken evangelical Christian from Texas Tech University in Lubbock. Her husband happens to be an evangelical Christian minister, as does her father. So she comes from this background that's typically associated with the far right political arena. But she's also a climate scientist. And so she has been able to really articulate rationale and reasons and using the language of evangelical Christians to talk about the need to understand and respond to climate science. And she was here a few years ago and spoke at Brigham Young University and the University of Utah and Utah State University. And I had an occasion to spend some time with Catherine, meeting with the joint editorial boards of all of the Bonneville Communications companies, so KSL-TV, KSL Radio, Deseret News, KSL.com. It was a room packed with probably 30 different people representing the editorial leadership of these organizations. And she said, we know that climate change is a political topic, but it's a moral and ethical imperative. And we need to hear from institutions like our media about this. And there's been some kind of tepid response since then from Bonneville Communications and its affiliated companies in doing this, you know, responding to this and talking about climate change ever so slightly in their discourse. But after meeting with the editorial boards, we then had an opportunity to go meet with a couple of general authorities. And that was a very small, intimate meeting. We were meeting with Richard Hinckley, who's the son of Gordon B. Hinckley, former LDS prophet, and had just become an emeritus general authority. But she asked the question, you know, what conversations are going on in the church around climate change? And Elder Hinckley said, probably not enough. And it's a topic that's discussed with some frequency among the leadership of the church, but because of its political discourse that's so polarizing, they've been very tentative about making statements. And he made an interesting commentary that one of the best things that can happen is that the grassroots movement around environment can be much more effective in kind of turning the tide on the political discourse. So for me, that was very motivating. I'd been involved with helping to launch a couple of LDS Mormon environmental organizations, LDS Earth Stewardship and Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance, and really see that there's a place for these. So I guess to the question, it's a long way to answer the question. A couple of things that I would say within the church, we often think of the church as being a very top-down structure, but what I heard from Elder Hinckley in this occasion was it also is a bottom-up structure, and we need to be talking about these things in our local congregations and be visible as Latter-day Saints in community conversations at the community council level with your local city councils, and just exactly what Rachel did when she went and talked to her mayor and said, we need a recycling program in our community. And so, I mean, if I were to wave a magic wand and say, what are a few things that the church could do, I'm thinking of the church collectively. I think every one of us should go home and say, you know, how do we start a recycling program in our ward meeting house? How do we reduce our consumption of disposable goods in all of our activities? How do we encourage people to walk to church, which is actually in a letter from the 1970s from the First Presidency to every congregation of the church that says we encourage saints to walk to church when they can. You know, the church doesn't emphasize these things, but there's no reason that as lay members we can't emphasize these things and encourage those around us to speak out as well. And so that's one of the things that I try to do and would encourage everybody here to do is be an enabler for conversations in your communities, particularly in your religious communities.
As far as where we are, I do think there has been some change happening. I've been noticing more conversations, more people at least talking and thinking about some of these issues. I went to a presentation, I'm trying to remember her name, but she was part of the Union for Concerned Scientists. She spoke at the city library downtown about climate change and the impacts. The interesting thing was is that the Deseret News actually did a pretty good write-up. The other interesting thing was that there were a lot of really negative comments directed toward the Deseret News for doing such a thing, which was fascinating, a little disappointing. But I was really glad the Deseret News did that. I haven't sent them a thank you note yet. I should probably do that. But I think there is sort of a little bit of a swell that is ready to expand. And I think, kind of like what Soren was saying, is if we go out and we have these conversations. I actually just recently met with one of the counselors in the state presidency specifically about single-use plastics. And he said, nobody's ever really brought this up. I mean, he sort of blinked at me. He's like, well, we hadn't really thought of that. You know, nobody's really talking about it. And so we talked about it. I haven't heard any updates yet. I was out of town last weekend. But I think that sort of thing, and finding ways to, again, reframe, but to make it something that becomes a community issue and sort of empowering us. I think in the church for a while now, we've sort of been consumers of gospel instead of users, active users of it. And I think in the realm of, you know, climate change and taking care of the earth, we need to start being more proactive and not just wait for the leadership to say, okay, you've been called to be the environmental justice somebody. I would love that to be a calling, actually. But you know, so don't just wait around. Start talking to your friends and your ministering sisters and brothers and the leadership. And start with the smaller changes. I'd love to see for us to go back to the days of dishwashers and reusable plates. We have enough thrift stores, I'm sure we could supply. Things like that. And then using that as a way to every other church that I visited, which they always have a dishwasher and plates and cups. And we don't do that. We just got away from it for convenience. But we need to look at that bigger picture, and we need to be proactive as regular people in the church, not just wait for marching orders.
Good stuff. So the question, how we're doing as a church, I think overall, not very well. I think I get pretty discouraged about the lack of conservation ethics in our church, especially right now with the current political situation we're in. I work a lot in conservation, as does Madison, in southern Utah, and there's a lot of animosity towards Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and our public lands, our Forest Service and BLM lands. And so that's discouraging to me. There are bright spots. There are people doing some really great work. I have professors, friends at BYU who are doing great research and doing some great things. Paul Cox is a world-renowned scientist, LDS professor, former professor at BYU, who helped save rainforest in Samoa and has discovered all kinds of chemicals from plants that are used in medicines. So there's people in the church that are doing some great things, but overall, I don't think we're doing a great job. The church also has a few buildings that are LEED certified, but why not make them all energy efficient? And why not put... So one of my things would be putting solar panels on every new church building. Church ward building, BYU building, education building, seminary. I mean, think of all the thousands of buildings we have around the world. If we put solar panels on all those, that would be amazing. So that's number one. I have a long list, so I'm trying to decide which of my other two. So number two, I'm going to refer back to the beautiful natural areas that I would like the church to come out strongly and say, let's protect the Grand Canyon. Keep it from being mined by uranium around it. And let's protect Bears Ears, and let's add more natural areas so we can have places to go and seek solitude and peace and inspiration in these natural places. So that would be my second one. The third one, there's a bunch of options, but I'm going to go with eat meat sparingly. Have you ever heard of that? Has anybody heard of eat meat sparingly?
Never.
DNC 89. We consume too much meat, and it uses lots of water, lots of land, lots of electricity, creates pollution. There's lots of chemicals that go into it. So if we all would follow DNC 89 a little better, eating less meat, that would help our planet a lot. And I commend my wife for being even better at this than me. So those are my things. Solar panels, promoting conservation of natural areas, and eating meat sparingly.
Excellent. I've got like 15 more questions that like we could go on for a couple hours. But I want to make sure that you guys have some time to ask some questions. So we'll end on this one. Let me see. Let me find it again. Okay. When you think about the environmental crisis, are you optimistic or pessimistic? Why? And what gives you hope?
Take it by turns, honestly. But my daughter just recently had me listen to Greta Thunberg from Sweden. I don't know if you've heard about this girl. She's 16 now, and she's got Asperger's, but she has become sort of an international face of the youth movement. And one of the things that she said in her TED Talk was, she said, we've got to stop having pep talks because they don't work. We need action. And once we have action, then we will have hope. And the thing that I have noticed is that there are so many ideas, so many clever ideas that people that are, you know, PhDs down to high school students coming up with these really great ideas. We have the creativity and the ingenuity to scale up these different solutions. I was recently reading about biochars, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is blowing my mind. Different ways of sequestering, and we have the solutions. We may not have all of them scaled. What we need is people taking action. And so the question is how do we persuade other people to take action and to improve our own actions? You know, the personal is political, and it's also environmental. Our personal actions do count for something. It may be a small drop in the bucket, but it is one of those drops. And the more drops we put into it, the bigger the impact will be. But more importantly, the more we do it, the more we talk about it with our acquaintances, the more they will also start to consider those things and make those changes and then expand their sphere of influence. And we need that snowball type of effect as soon as possible. And so usually I vote for optimism because we have the ability to do it and we have the science, we have a number of solutions, and a lot of them make money. Or they would once we get them going. But we just need to take that step. And sometimes that's when I get discouraged, especially when I see the deniers who have, they're either denying the data for various reasons, or they're saying, well, there are other priorities, or all of those things. I don't think there is a higher priority at this point if we want to continue to learn and to grow and to protect this earth for ourselves and our descendants. So I will vote for optimism. Great. But, you know, I have my days.
Sometimes I'm optimistic. Sometimes I'm very discouraged. So it goes up and down, like Rachel said. I think we can solve some of our problems. I think we've got a long way to go. I think I'm excited for the new generation, like Greta Thunberg and the younger people who are learning about science and land management in school. I think they're learning more than we did when I was young. So in that sense, I'm excited, but we've really dug a deep hole for them for the future. So it's both exciting and discouraging at the same time.
I guess I would follow up to say I'm not optimistic about the outcome because, you know, we have enough scriptural reference to say it ain't going to be good. But I'm very optimistic about the role that we can play in showing whose side we're on. I'm really inspired. I'm going to share with you an opening statement from a talk that Elder L. Tom Perry of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints gave back in 1989. He said, traveling to the four corners of the world, we encounter, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, we encounter famine, climate change, pollution. The causes of the difficulties proves that they are man-made and that solutions are within man's ability to accomplish. We don't hear about climate change very often from the pulpit, but there it is. We know it's man-made, and we have general authorities that reiterate that and that we can create solutions. We are incredibly capable of solving problems when we put our full heart, might, mind, and strength and draw on divine intervention, mostly to help encourage us. And so I guess what I would conclude is to say I'm not so optimistic about the outcome, but I'm very optimistic about the role that I can play if I raise my voice. I mean, in some ways it feels a little bit like Moroni watching the destruction of his people all around him, and yet when I read the words in the closing of the Book of Mormon, he was a very optimistic person, even in spite of what he was witnessing going on around him. So I you know, and that was kind of the message that Elder Perry gave in that talk at LDS General Conference, is that we can be optimistic in the face of great calamity and great challenge and difficulty, because these are man-made challenges. They're almost always man-made challenges, and we have the capacity to overcome them, or at least to advocate and find solutions and offer those in a way that demonstrates whose side we're on. And I think God will make up the difference in our own attitude, no matter what we see around us, to be optimistic about the role that we can play in showing whose side we're on.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. Can we get a round of applause for our panel? All right, so we're going to open it up for audience Q&A. Just come on up, and I'll try and not get tangled up in the cords here and trip off the podium.
If you have questions for our panelists. All right, so I feel like my love for the environment was influenced a lot by my LDS upbringing. But growing up, I also saw Utah overwhelmingly vote people into office that, in my view, are antithetical to the environment. One in particular that comes to mind is ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee, Rob Bishop. I get confused when, like, other people who grew up in the same state as me, in the same religion, don't have that same passion to be like good stewards of the earth, and I'd love to hear you guys' take on maybe where that disconnect might be.
Can I take a crack at that? This is a message that I repeat many times. The pioneers came to these lands, and they had to fight to survive. They had to plow the land. They had to cut the trees. They had to dam the rivers. They had to kill the wild animals to survive. They couldn't worry about damaging wildflowers or rare plants or fish or any of the stuff that we worry about now, because they had to just survive. I think that mentality has persisted into today for some people. I think some people have moved beyond that into a conservation ethic, because we can. Our great-grandparents didn't have the choice to eat broccoli in the wintertime or, you know, Caesar salad. They had to eat meat, they had to kill animals, and they had to dominate the landscape or die. It was a pretty stark, the options were pretty stark back then. So I think now we need to transition to a different mentality. We don't have to kill all the animals. We don't have to use up all the land. We don't have to cut all the trees and plow up every bit of soil just to survive. So I think we need to transition, and I think some people haven't transitioned yet, to the modern era of more abundant resources and the option to protect some areas, to protect some animals, some habitats, and to use better energy sources. I mean, in the old days, I heard that a man would walk around with a white shirt, and by the end of the day, his collar would be black from the soot, from the coal that had been burned. We're lucky. We don't have that problem anymore. We're starting to be able to use solar panels and wind energy to produce a lot of energy. So I'm hoping that we're on a transition, and some people are just a little slower to transition. Because I agree entirely. I don't understand how people can grow up in the same faith as me and be so antithetical and antagonistic towards conservation and public land management and all that. So thanks.
I think it's also a product of the political alliance we've made with the right spectrum as a culture. I'm not saying across the board, but and so we have prioritized other social issues. that we felt collectively were of a higher priority. I personally think this is a higher priority. I think actually they're all interconnected. As I've learned more about the various civil rights and poverty, immigration issues, they are all connected. And once we start addressing climate change as central to all of those issues, as well as those issues, I think a lot of things will start solving together. But until we reframe and start recognizing the other traditions and doctrines that we have for not wasting. When I was on my mission, sometimes we had a car area, and one of the strategies so that you didn't get fewer miles next month was at the end of the month was to just keep driving around so that you'd use up your miles so that you would get the same amount next month, because if you didn't, you wouldn't get... And that made no sense to me. Well, that and that to me really contradicts our history, our legacy of thrift and using resources wisely. I mean, the pioneers did have a survival minimum to meet, but they also had to survive on the land here, so they could not exhaust the resources. And there was actually, I mean, Brigham Young has a quote about how we've got to buy local and we've got to take care of our local lands. And so we've forgotten that part of it, and I think part of that is the way we've aligned ourselves with other political issues.
The only thing I would add to that is that just encourage not to be discouraged because others don't share your same value about everything. You know, I lean politically to the left, and yet I'm consider myself fiercely independent, and so I look with great skepticism on all political parties, and I try and find, you know, within each of them something that resonates so that I can have meaningful conversations with friends and family members and neighbors that share different political views. But the best thing that I think we can do is to just demonstrate in how we live that, you know, this is a belief system that's important. As Mark talked about, I can demonstrate that I find sacred space in bear's ears, even when not everybody sees the bear's ears and their preservation as being a fundamental need. I can speak out for my brothers and sisters of the native traditions that find those spaces sacred and testify of their sacred nature, even if others think that they should be mined and you know, turned over for various extractive industries. So, you know, even the Rob Bishops of the world can be talked to when you find common language to speak about. And we share a faith, which means that we can find at least some common language. And, you know, I've had very few conversations with Rob Bishop, but have with many of our federal legislators. And you know, I find them all to be approachable. And sometimes we walk away and disagree as much as when we started the conversation. But I never hesitate to tie my faith to what I share, even in a political arena, with people that I share a faith with, because I think that is a way to build common ground that ultimately may bring some voices around to something that is less politically motivated and more motivated by divinity.
Thanks. Anyone else?
Somehow these mics are always too tall. I have just a couple comments and one question. First comment is, a lot of what we do in environmental activism seems to be directed at long term, and that flies in the face of a lot of human, if you will, evolution. We're evolved to be very good in facing crises, but very, very bad in facing things that develop slowly and happen slowly. And global climate change is a perfect example of something that is not an in-your-face crisis, but something that's happening slowly and almost imperceptively. And so it's a matter of how do we get people interested in solving something that looks to them like a long-term problem that can be delayed, whose solution can be delayed infinitely because we don't have to worry about it right now, because what we can do won't make a whole lot of difference when you look at the long term. At least that's the attitude. As I see it, there are two things that we can do. politics is how we leverage our individual feelings. So if there's anybody listening to this in this room or on the tape or whatever, if we're not politically involved, we're missing our chance to actually leverage and multiply our own effect. And the other thing is the role of churches in this, faith traditions, have the wonderful opportunity to decide which long-term efforts are worth looking at, because churches are, you know, in essence, looking at what is of eternal importance. And so what churches can do is say, taking care of the earth is something of eternal importance. And you may not think there's much to be done right now, but there are some things you can do. So I think when we talk with our friends and neighbors and our faith communities, we can emphasize that, look, our church teaches us that we need to be concerned for the long term. And the consequence of that is that here are some things we can do on the short term. And so basically the question I have, given that background, is how do you think we can best talk to our friends and neighbors and fellow citizens in a faith community? How do you think we can best get that across to them?
Well, Soren is a good example. He quotes church leaders and church letters and announcements. So I think that's one way, is we can use the church's own writings, because people should respect those if they're in that faith community. And another example of that is the website that the church has. What's it called?
Environmental Stewardship and Conservation.
Something about stewardship and conservation. Do you remember what it is?
I know I have it bookmarked on my web browser, but I do that because I can't remember it.
There's a nice web page. If you come to our table, we'll find it. If you come to the Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance table down the hall, we'll have it. But if you go to the church website, there's some website about conservation.
It's one of their essays. So if you find one of the Gotham Topics essays, it's one of those essays. So it's in there.
I was thinking it was something different.
Say it in the mic. Oh. They'll want that.
It's so if you go to just the LDS.org, the website, if you find our Gospel Topics essays and you find stewardship, there's an entire essay on stewardship that has a lot of great information on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's see if we can pull it up.
Another thing is find a way to get politically active. There are politically active Mormon groups out there that are concerned about the environment. Few of them are represented today. There's Mormon Women for Ethical Government. There's a few other places where people are talking about it. So I would at least like them on Facebook so that you see what they're saying. And then you can use some of their events, their quotes, their networking. And you can use those as you have conversations with people and go do events and start building that network. And then I'm part of another Utah political group on Facebook, but that's not particularly LDS. But, in fact, I've had to say, no. But one of their mottos is call every day. I don't call every day, but they have a list of all of the Utah legislators and the governor that you can call every day, including like the ones that go to the federal as well as the ones for your different areas. You can take that a step further by going to your state legislators rather than the federal ones and call them. And maybe it's just as simple as, what are you doing to address the climate crisis and the environmental pollution that Utah is experiencing? Those are some ways to do it. And then just keeping up on the current news, all of those things will help you to be able to speak with other people. And if you're reading the articles and talking with people, it will be that much easier to talk about it with members of your ward or your leadership, your local church leadership, things like that, even in Sunday school. I mean, if we can start linking that up, more people will talk about it, more people will prioritize it.
I remember I referenced a little bit earlier this letter from the First Presidency back in the late 70s. It was during the energy crisis, and that was really the theme of it. But it had about five things you can do. You can walk to church. You can turn your thermostat up in your home, or in the summer and turn it down in the winter. You can carpool and use public transit. You can so there were a list of things you can do to conserve energy, and you know, it was a very significant directive from Latter-day Saint Church leadership. And I remember growing up in Austin, you know, we had a discussion about that in our family about, you know, how can we do this? We had to drive a half hour to go to church. And so walking to church wasn't a very practical thing to do. But there were other things that we could walk to. And so I remember my mom said, you know, I'm not going to drive you to soccer practice. I'm not going to drive you to school. I'm not going to drive you to piano lessons. And so I became very active and rode my bicycle everywhere or walked, and that just became part of how I do things, and I do it still today. So when I moved to Utah, I thought, yeah, this is really cool. I can walk to church now. I've never been able to do that. And I've walked, you could probably count on one hand the number of times I haven't walked to church in the 25 years that I've lived here. A few years ago, when I was serving as in a leadership calling, and we were having a discussion at the stake level, I brought this issue up with our stake presidency, and I said, you know, we should encourage more people to walk to church, it kind of got dismissed and pushed aside, and then it came up again a few months later. In the context of, you know, being active in missionary work in your communities. And so I said, you know, maybe there's another tack I could take. And so I said, you know, if we walk to church, we'll see our neighbors out working in their yards on the way to church, and it's a great opportunity to have conversations with them, and they can see how important going to church is. And sometimes our neighbors get a little upset when we drive two blocks to go to church as well. But changing the framework of the message really changed. And there were a couple of people in the room that said, you know, that's a really good idea. And so, you know, talking about walking to church because of climate change and air quality dropped like a lead weight. But talking about it in a different context, all of a sudden there were others in the room that kind of keyed into that. And one of those, just the week ago when we were having a little neighborhood get-together, said, you know, Soren, you brought this up a few years ago, and it was really meaningful. And he moved away and lived in Louisiana for a couple years and just moved back into the neighborhood again. And he said, you know, being where I couldn't walk to church in Louisiana and now coming back where I can, I think, you know, I'm really impressed that you would bring this up and that you were really consistent in bringing it up. So sometimes it's just that consistency can be really important to kind of move the needle a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you guys for your questions. Can we give one more round of applause for our presenters?